Mitzvah Ayin, the 70th mitzvah. Mishor Shea Mitzvah, the Virkas Hashem. Again, this mitzvah was sort of combined into two. These two mitzvahs are combined into one by the Sefer HaChinuch and artificially rebroken up into two by the printers. And you have here in brackets, Mitzvah Ayin, Lav, the Virkas Hashem. It's really one paragraph in the Sefer HaChinuch, one section, one chapter, containing two separate mitzvahs. And this is talking about the commandment not to curse God. We already talked about the reasoning behind the mitzvah of cursing a judge, but here we're talking the reason behind the mitzvah of cursing God. Somebody says something so bad, the person becomes empty mikol tova of anything good. All the glory of his soul is turned into destruction, a destroyer. He is considered to be like animals. And the exact same thing that God caused is created to be the difference between people and animals, which is the power of speech, as we know the Targum Unclus, when it says that in the pasuk that the man Adam became a living soul. It's the Targum translates la ruach memalala, speaking. It's a speaking soul as opposed to a living soul. So the point of life, the distinguishing feature of human life, is really the power of speech. So with the power of speech, mavdil hu es atzmo l'ro, motzi atzmo l'gamrei mikol geder hadas, that you distinguish yourself for the bad, and you bring yourself out completely from all categories of knowledge and your wits about you. V'nase kesheretz nimas v'nechlech l'matu menu, you're considered to be like a disgusting, creepy thing. So the Torah commanded us regarding this, because the good God wants our good. And anything that, any speech that causes the prevention of our receiving good things from him is against his wishes, so he wants us not to do it because he's going to get mad at us if we curse him. Midine ha-mitzvah, the halachos of the mitzvah, kigo ma'ashe perishu shein ha-chiyuv ad shi'afaris es Hashem ha-miyuchad shu yud kevavke, that you're not chayiv in this, you don't receive the full penalty for cursing the name of God unless you actually pronounce the name of God, which we never do. We always substitute wherever it's written yud kevavke. We substitute aleph dalet ado, and instead of actually pronouncing with a yud sound and a hey sound, and a vav sound, etc. So you're not actually fully chayiv, unless you pronounce it the way it's written. O shel alef dalet nun yud kedas ktsas mefarshin. The Rambam himself brings a machlokas. In the Rambam Sefer of Mishneh Torah, he ever brings two different opinions. He usually just says, this is what I think, and that's it. But the Rambam here brings two different opinions in the Mishneh Torah, whether you're also chayiv for saying ado, or you're only chayiv if you actually pronounce the yud and the hey. Yeah.
That's a question.
J-E-H-O-V.
Yeah.
Yeah. It can't be said that's a full violation of pronouncing the name of God. Normally, you're not allowed to pronounce the name of God at all with the correct pronunciation as it's written, even if you don't curse it. But
that can't possibly be because there's no J sound in
right. You know, but since it's based off it's incorrect on many levels. But since that is a representation of what the name of God is supposed to be in the actual written fashion, so. Well, it's not proper to pronounce that.
So we refer to Jay's witnesses,
right,
at all.
Right, Jay, right.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not proper to say that. Mm-hmm. That's true. Well, you're not allowed to do sins even if there are no Edom. The only question of the Edom is the if you get the punishment or not. The earthly punishment. I mean, pronouncing the name of God with the correct letters is not one of the negative commandments per se. You're just not supposed to do it. It's not one of the... I mean, the tradition was lost, but there are ways of reconstructing it. There are Greek transcriptions of the Greek letter. Yeah, there are ways of reconstructing it.
So the academic one is anything
probably
close?
Correct.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Probably correct.
Okay. The academic one is probably more or less correct. Yeah. The Greek transliteration is Yota Alpha Beta Epsilon.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I mean, because the name was pronounced by when the Kohanim did Birkas Kohanim Deiduchend in the Beis Hamikdash, they did pronounce the actual name as it was written. It's not forbidden. It's not one in the proper context. So it is just a normal discourse, a normal reading. So this is the way the name is supposed to be pronounced. The Rebbe Akiva says in the Perek Chelek that somebody who pronounces the name of God as it's written has no Chelek in Olam Haba. So that's a pretty harsh statement. So even though it's not technically one of the negative commandments, when is it? One of the, how many negative commandments are there? 365, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's not one of those, but it's still not supposed to do it.
So how could he say that you have no Olam Haba?
You also don't have Olam Haba if you read Svarim HaChitzonim, external books that you're not supposed to be reading. They're not. It's not one of the Lavan either.
We're all
going
to lead to hell, it
seems. We're going
to hell. But that is a question, what that means. Some say, and right. Some say it means Homer, some say it means, it's a question.
There are some who say that this practice of writing G-D is completely the Irish kite, and should be discouraged. I mean, the Rav, I believe,
The Rav didn't say it was Narishkeit. The Rav just said it doesn't help.
Oh.
That since G-G is designed to be a representation of God, so then if you hold that name of God written in secular lettering has holiness, then G-D also has holiness.
Oh,
so that you might as well write G-O-D.
Or, like a hey, apostrophe, whatever it was, it also doesn't help then, right? If in terms of the...
According to that approach.
So, whether you're chayav or not depends on how you perceive it?
What do you mean?
Whether you perceive G-D as...
No, everybody perceives that. Everybody perceives in the written orthography G-D, everybody knows that dash just stands for an O.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
So you really can't... escape whatever punishment Rabbi Akiva says.
No, Rabbi Akiva is only Hoges Hashem Bosiotza. Rabbi Akiva's punishment is only if you say Yud, and then the Hey, and then the Vav, and then the Hey.
Uh-huh.
So according to some authorities, even if you say Aleph Dali, even if you say Ado, then you're also, and you curse it, then you are fully liable for the punishment. Umash Amru Shebechol Yom Vayom Sholinas Eidim V'Kinoi. That when the Sanhedrin is trying a case of somebody who cursed the name of God, so they ask the Eidim do not actually repeat what they heard, because that would not be a good idea. So they would say instead, Yake Yossi as Yossi, that Yossi should hit Yossi, Yossi being, since it also has four letters, then it's a representation of the Yudke Vavke. So Nigmar Hadin, so once the Sanhedrin is... basically decided that this man or woman or whatever is liable for the full penalty of somebody who curses the name of God. Motzien kol adam lachutz, so they take all the spectators out of the courtroom and they just the court there and the witnesses. V'sholinis hagodol shebeidim, the most important, the most chashuv, the most elder of the witnesses. V'omer lo emor ma sheshamata b'ficha, say exactly what you heard, because you cannot issue the final judgment unless there was some misunderstanding, so maybe you're putting an innocent person to death. So the witnesses, for the purposes of the trial, this is not considered an actual violation of this mitzvah, they must repeat the exact blasphemy that they heard from the person.
Mm-hmm.
The hu omer, and the elder witness, repeats exactly what he heard the person on trial say. The judges stand on their feet and they rip their garments. They rip kriya, which is a sign of avelos, and they can never, ever sew up that tear.
Uh-huh.
This is one of the halachos and different types of kriyas that you have in avelos. Sometimes you're allowed to sew up the tear, sometimes you're not. So in this case is one of the more severe kind that you're not allowed to sew up the tear. V'ha'id ha'sheni omer afani kamo shamati. And the other witness says, I heard exactly what he said. Bim hayu edim rab. See, the point is that the second witness says, wait, what? You heard that? Oh, I heard something else. Then the trial is gone. You have to make sure they heard exactly the same thing. Bim hayu edim rabim kulam omrim kain. All the witnesses have to say one after the other, yes, I heard exactly as the first witness said. So normally we have a halacha that if you go back on a transaction in what we call toch kedei dibur, enough time to say shalom alecha, Rabbi, if you say a very short period of time, you have to say, to undo anything you just said. In a few cases, one of them is kiddushin, if you say hariyat mikudesh esli, and you give the ring, and then half a second later, you take back the ring and say, enoch mikudesh esli, you're not mikudeshes, then that also is invalid. But most of the time, such a retraction does work. So this is one of the cases where the retraction does not work. That even if he said, no, I don't mean it at all, then he still receives the penalty of skila, because that's just considered to be, you know, nobody would say such a thing without thinking twice. So there's no presumption that person might have the power to retract it later. Umishikidef Hashem b'shem avodah zarah kanaim pogim bo. So if you curse God with a name of an avodah zarah, with an idol or other foreign deity, so the halach is kanaim pogim bo, that if he does this publicly, then anybody is authorized to kill the person during the act. It's similar to the halacha that we know from Pinchas, Parshas Pinchas, where there was a man who was publicly having relations with a non-Jewish woman, and in that case also it's kanoim pogimbo, that if somebody sees him in the midst of the act, then he's allowed to kill the man as long as it's during the act. Vimlo pogubo vabit levezden eno niskal. But if they, let's say, the kanoi, the zealous person who was going to kill them, did not kill them, then he does not receive the penalty in the court during normal proceedings. Until you actually use one of the specific names of God, as we said before. The reason that he doesn't receive the penalty of skila is because even he realizes, since he's not using the actual explicit name of God, he realizes that he's being stupid. He's not, he's some level of mental wits about him, that he's not violating the full prohibition of cursing the name of God. So that's the reason he does not receive the full penalty in Bezdin. It's only that Omikomokum is going to explain. But anyway, Pogimbo Kanoi Machar Hishchis Vehisi Vehez Panav Ladaber Dvarim Roim Koela. Since he still did something so corrupt and so disgusting and so brazen to speak such things, so then he deserves to die, but since he doesn't receive the full court proceedings because there was still a slightly lower level of infraction here.
Somebody would say, may Malach, you know, do something to
right, yeah.
Hashem, or something like that. Something of that in that order, okay?
Right.
May Malach?
I wanted to come with a deity that nobody worships anymore.
Yes, good idea. Umash Amru, that's a halacha. Shem Elohim Achrim Lo Yizachir Al Picha, that we're not supposed to mention the names of deities that are currently worshipped. That if deities that aren't worshipped anymore, Zeus and whatever, so we're allowed to mention them, but other deities that are currently worshipped, we're not even supposed to mention their names.
What if you work with an Indian whose name is one of the Indian deities which is currently worshipped?
Really? They name people
like
after
Nightfall,
deities?
Right? The novelist.
Shiva.
Oh, really?
Yes, that's right. Shiva Naipaul.
Yeah, it could be that if the name is also used for people, then it's okay. It could be it has to be a name that's exclusive for a deity.
A lot of Christian students have the name of their god.
Right. So that's
much less of a problem because that in fact was a. That was simply a Jewish name back in the time of the.
Exactly what happened. It was a funny story, actually. That I in Asar Batavis during my year in yeshiva in Israel. My Rosh Yeshiva said shir on this topic to entertain people because they were a little a little bit out of it because of the fast. So he gave a shir on mentioning the names of other gods. So he was up to a certain point in the shir. So he said, "So Rabosai, what do you think? Is it mutter to say Jesus?" there was a silence for a second. So interesting fellow raised his hand. He said, "Well, Rebbe just said it."
So what is the final answer?
No, he said because it's the name of a person. It's not a name of a deity per se. Because they deified a person, so it doesn't since it's used for people.
All pagan gods' names are.
That was a name. It was actually like a variant of Yehoshua or something like that.
Right.
But in the time, it was like a.
Yes, but I'm saying all other pagan gods may also be names.
Ancient Greece was named Zeus.
Yeah.
No? That was the name reserved for the deity.
I didn't know anyone that knew Zeus, but I wouldn't be.
Nowadays it might be, but that's because it's not worshipped anymore. In ancient Greece, it would be ridiculous.
The kid's named Mohammed.
Well, Mohammed's not a deity at all.
That's the prophet.
That would,
Only
That they're very touchy about.
Yeah.
You don't want to call their religion Mohammedism, as they used to.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that's like, and Churchill and so on used to, you know, used to be the usage.
Oh, really?
That is definitely not a way to ingratiate yourself with a Muslim, is to refer to religion that way.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
I've heard them called Mohammedans, but I never heard their religion called Mohammedism. Interesting. Okay. That if you, anybody, not just the judges, that if you hear a person state a curse to God, that if the person is Jewish who's cursing, then you have to tear your garments. And if you hear a non-Jew curse the name of God, then you are not required to tear your garments. Right. But the other one came. Anyway, Mishumet Haya. So, Rav Shake, there was a story in Tanakh where Rav Shake, who was a Syrian official, came to the outskirts of Yerushalayim, and he started speaking to the people, and he apparently spoke Hebrew, which is a tip-off that, according to Chazal, he was a Mishumet, that he was a Jew who went to the Assyrian religion. So it says over there that the leaders, the Jewish leaders, Eliakim and Shevna, they tore their garments when they heard him speaking. So the reason, in other words, this would be difficult if we thought that since you don't have to tear your garments when you hear a goy, curse the name of God, so this would be difficult. So the answer that Chazal gave is that he was really Jewish and he converted to Assyrianism. That this is a unique halacha that before the person is put to death, so the judge and the edim, judges and the edim, have to lay their hands on top of the person who's supposed to be put to death. You don't even have to do that when you come first smicha. You don't even have to lay hands. But here is the case where you actually do have to lay your hands.
You get smicha on a blasphemer.
Okay. Right, so you you put your hands on the blasphemer, and you say, your blood is on your head because you are the one who caused yourself to die. I mean, anybody who commits a sin is the one causing himself to die, but you did something particularly stupid. This is the only case where somebody's put to death by the Bezdin that is that they have this ceremony of putting the hand, laying the hands. That anybody who hears, all those who hear, shall place their hands on his head. The rest of the details, Midvarim of Sanhedrin. Explained the Masechet Sanhedrin in the 7th parak, parak Zion. The Noigis or Zeb Bechol Makom Bechol Zman. Obviously, this applies in all places and all times. So if you violate this commandment and you curse the name of God in the way that we just explained, then you receive the penalty of skila, stoning, if you did it in Eretz Yisrael, according to the judgment of those who have the real smicha. And as it's pointed out many times, that the Sefer HaChinuch always likes to say that it has to be in Eretz Yisrael, but that's not necessarily true, that the smuchim, people who receive the real smicha in Eretz Yisrael, are entitled to judge cases that require smuchim and all over the globe. So the sin and the judgment do not have to take place in Eretz Yisrael, but the people have to have received smicha, the judges have to have received smicha in Eretz Yisrael. So nowadays we no longer have the possibility of issuing the penalty of stoning, so instead we put him in cherem, which is excommunication. There are two levels of excommunication. There's nidui, which is the lesser type of excommunication. There's cherem, which is the very strong excommunication. So since this person did something so bad, then you put him in the higher type of excommunication, which is cherem, which is even more restrictions on doing business and things like that. Mitzvah Ayin Aleph, the 71st mitzvah, is the same genre. Shelo l'kalas hanosi, we should not curse the head. So to see exactly in a second what the head means. Nemar v'nasi b'am chalos or a head in your nation you shall not curse. Uba ha'perush shanasi zehamelech, the accepted explanation that nasi, which can mean many things, can mean chieftain, and in modern Hebrew it means president. In times of the Mishnah, there was no such concept of president per se in the times of the Tanakh. In the times of the Mishnah, it meant the head of the Sanhedrin, who was the figurehead of the whole Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael. So really, the head of the Jewish community was the king in the times when we had a sovereign kingdom. But this includes also really the main explanation is that this refers to the king, but it also includes the Nasi, who's the head of the Sanhedrin, and who took the place of the king in later times and was in fact also a descendant of David HaMelech. Who Rosh Sanhedrin Gedola, that's the head of the highest court. Shenikra Nasi Gamkin is also called Nasi Lefisha Kavanas Akosu Lahazirenu Al Komi Shu Rosh Sirora Al Yisrael Bemem Shalas Malchus Bemem Shalas Torah. Really, the whole point of this commandment is that we shouldn't curse somebody who's above us. We talked about judges, but here is a separate idea that somebody who has executive power as opposed to judicial power, whether he is the king or whether he takes the place of the king, whether he says it's cute, Memshalas Malchus or Memshalas Torah, whether it's the kingdom of kingship or the kingdom of Torah. It sounds like something that we should be hearing about in Bnei Brak or something, where the Memshalas HaTorah, or I don't know,
so
or Chabad, or who knows what. Yeah.
Could be somebody non-Jewish also.
No, it's talking about Jewish leaders of the Jewish community specifically.
Curse the Tsar all you want, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Curse the Tsar.
So you have to bless the Tsar in the country.
You have to pray for his
welfare,
but not.
Oh, so you can curse. How is that?
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, we all
know
that.
You're supposed to pray for there that they have success and that they protect the Jews, but if they do something bad, then you're allowed to curse them.
So Bisman has said, I guess it varies from community to community. What would be an example of a Nasi?
There is none.
There is none. None at all.
I mean, the spirit of the halacha would not allow you to curse somebody who's. You're not allowed to curse any Jew, but specifically. To be extra careful not to curse anybody in a position of authority, but the technical halacha does not apply nowadays.
So it doesn't apply at all.
No.
So Yehuda Nasi then.
Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was under the technical parameters of this. Yes.
Right, but that's about it then.
Because he was the head of the whole Jewish community in Eretz Israel. He took the place of the king. There's nothing like that nowadays.
And the Rosh Galusa, and Bavel,
No, because the Rosh Galusa was not. It sounds here like he has to actually be the head of the High Sanhedrin.
Ah.
There was no Sanhedrin in Bavel, so that was the Sanhedrin had official authority over the entire Jewish people, which the Babylonian authorities didn't necessarily have. The Rosh Galusa was also less of a religious figurehead. He was a purely more, Memshalas Malchus type of figurehead, but in outside of Eretz Israel, so he didn't speak for the whole Jewish community in the same way. Mishor she'a mitzvah, the reasoning for the mitzvah, lefi she'iav shal yishu b'nei adam mibli she'yasu echa mibeneham rosh al ha'achirim. That is impossible for society to exist without one person being on top of others. Lasos mitzvah so l'kayim gzerosav, to do what he commands and to fulfill his decrees. Mipnei she'a deos b'nei adam chalukim zemizeh, that people have different opinions. V'lo yaskimu kulam la'olam l'das achas. They're not going to all agree what to do, so you have to have someone arbitrarily, or have some way of forcing them all to be together. So is davar mikol advarim. To do anything, you have to have a system how to put that into place. So between that will come out the nullification and the collection of deeds. So no matter what, either whether he's right or wrong, we have to listen to what he says, because otherwise society wouldn't function. So that people should have success and they should do what is supposed to be done in the world. Sometimes people find in the leader's advice and his will real benefits, and sometimes they'll find it to be the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't always win with your leader, but you have to realize that you have to listen to what he says anyway.
So
this is better than just having squabbling all over the place, which causes total hefkerus, it causes total free-for-all, and is not good for society at all.
Because
the pointing of one person as the head is a reason for the benefit of society, as we said. So whether he is the Gadol Hador in Torah, whether he's supposed to teach us what the religion expects from us, or whether he has temporal power to prevent someone from taking advantage of someone less powerful than he is. Roy Hadavar Vachosher Shalo Anakel Bechvodo. It's important for us and appropriate for us that we should not make light his honor. Begam Shalo Lekalu Afilo Shalo Bafana. We shouldn't curse him even not in front of him. Bechol Shekan Bifnei him, certainly not in front of two witnesses who can hear what we're talking about. Kedei Shalo Novo Mitochach Lachlokimo. We shouldn't publicly disagree with him. Lefisha Hergil Harash Adam Margil Atzma Beino Levein Atzma Husof Maaseu. Because something that a bad way that somebody causes himself to act, that he causes himself to become used to doing something, even privately, that's what he's going to do. That's what he's that's the way he's going to act in all times. Machlokes alav kvar amarnu hefsed on imsa bishvilo. And even if you do it in private, then this is it's going to lead to bad things happening because you won't fully accept the authority of the leader.
There must be a distinction between machlokas, disagreeing, and cursing.
That's going to lead to machlokas. Cursing is going to lead to machlokas.
Oh. Okay, so in other words, you can't disagree then. It's Das Torah.
You can disagree privately, but you can't curse. You could try to, you know, try to get him to change his mind. You can contact your local congressman and see if... the spirit, yeah, but not the technical halacha. The technical halacha only applies to a Jewish organizations.
Spirit is sort of close to the laws against burning the flag or something like that. You know, it's like something which shows that you're, you know, that disrespect for the authority of the government.
Burning the Israeli flag, which I have witnessed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
See the American flag.
Well, burning the flag is a little different. That's speaking against the whole country in general. It's not talking about one specific person, right? It's not talking about the leader as bad. It's talking about the country shouldn't even exist, which is a whole level, different level of, Midinei ha-mitzvah,
the
halachos of the mitzvah, ma'asha'omer zichronim l'vracha, she'en chayev olav, ela ha-makalo b'shem okinu. You don't receive the full punishment unless you curse him, like we saw regarding the judge, that you don't receive the full penalty unless you curse him with the name of God or with a reference to God. Even if it's not a name of God, even if you say Rachum and Chanon or something like that, anything that alludes to God. You receive three sets of lashes. How does that happen? Mishum Elohim
Losek. Three sets or three lashes?
Three sets of lashes. Three sets of 39 lashes.
Why did it say sets?
Shalosh Malkios. Malchus is one set of lashes. Malchus is not one lash. So it's Mishum Elohim Lo Sekalel. So just like we saw there was a... that tells you not to curse the judges. So too, certainly if you're not allowed to curse the judges, you're not allowed to curse this guy. So it's a violation of Elohim Lo Sekalel as well. Mishum Benasiv Yamcha Lo Saor. And because of the specific mitzvah of a chieftain... in your people, you shall not curse. And umishum lo sekal al cherish, which is the mitzvah not to curse any Jew. So you have three sets of lashes. Shehu lav kol Yisrael. V'yaser prateh mevarim b'Sanhedrin. It's explained in Masech Sanhedrin. V'noheges b'zcharim u'nekevos ba'aretz u'v'chol makom sheniyah im alkenu o'im rosh Sanhedrin gedola. So it doesn't matter where the physical location is, as long as the Sanhedrin gedola is there and there's a head of it. Or we have a king of the Jewish people, even in exile. I guess theoretically that could happen. The whole state goes in exile, and the king is there, ready to go back at any time. Then this mitzvah applies. Over aleh v'kilo b'shem v'kinu. If you violate this and you curse the chieftain with the name of God or a reference to God, loke shalosh malchus, you receive three sets of lashes. In ben hanasi kilo, if the son of the nasi cursed his father. No. Loke Arba receives the fourth set of lashes. Shalosh Amarnu, the three that we said, V'acham Yishu Mekalov, even the fourth one is because of he cursed his father. So, how bad can you get? All right. But, again, the lesson we can learn from this is definitely the respect that we have to have for leaders, even if we don't agree with all their policies. It's an important measure for society. Okay, Mitzvah in Beis, the 72nd Mitzvah. Shelo lahaktim chukei hatavos, not to do early one of the mitzvahs regarding the produce of the land. Shelo naktim chukei hatavos k'tosom ak'tosom, that we should not do the laws of the land in their improper order. El shenotziem beseder, that we should separate the proper tithes, etc., in the correct order that is commanded in the Torah. Their inyan hazehu. The explanation of this is Shehachita keshetudash vetinoke hitevel, that before a wheat kernel is edible, really, then it's not considered to have what we call gemar malacha. It doesn't have the full food status yet, so you don't have to separate the tithes and you don't have to do all the laws that are relevant to the produce of the land. Of course, in Eretz Yisrael, this is how this applies. So once it's been threshed and cleaned, then this wheat is called, or any produce, really. It's a question of what kind of produce is required to have tithes separated, midah raisa and which midah rabbanan. But in any case, wheat certainly is chayav midah raisa, so then that is called tevel, which means untithed produce. Uperish tevel, hu hi tshuva shelo hutshema. Tevel means produce which was not tithed. What the proper order is as follows, that we are supposed to separate first the truma gedola, the great truma, which is given to straight from the Jew, the regular Jew, the Israelite, to the priests. There's no shear, there's no measurement regarding how much you're supposed to separate for the truma gedola. So technically, even one wheat kernel could exempt the entire wheat storage area. But Chazal said that we're supposed to give 1/50th, and it says also that cheap people will give 1/60th, and people who want it to be nice to the Kohanim will give 1/40th. But nowadays we don't give so much, because we go according to the Din D'oraisa that you only have to give a tiny amount, because since we don't actually give it to the Kohanim, so these halachos do not no longer apply. So from what's left after the truma gedola, we have to take the tithe. Vunikra maiserisha, and this is called the first tithe. So that's a tenth. From what's left, and then you have to take another tenth of what's left after the first tithe, which is called the second tithe. Betinosin truma la kohen, you have to give the truma to the priest, umaiser rishon levi, and you have to give the levi the maiser rishon, umaiser sheni yochlu ba'ala b'Yerushalayim. The maiser sheni has to be taken by the owner of the produce and eaten in Yerushalayim. Or you could redeem the maiser sheni with money and take the money to Yerushalayim and eat it there. But nowadays also, it's actually a disagreement whether you have to give the maiser rishon to the levi at all. Because the Maaser Rishon, you could say that the Levi has to prove that he's a Levi, and then you give him the Maaser Rishon. Mm-hmm. Because the Maaser Rishon has no Kedusha. The Levi is allowed to eat it even when he's Tomei. And even a Yisrael is allowed to eat it, which is not the case in Truma. If the Yisrael gets invited to the Levi's house, and the Levi serves Maaser Rishon, that's perfectly fine. Whereas that's if he goes to the Kohen's house and the Kohen's serving Truma, then he's not allowed to eat it. The regular Yisrael is not allowed to eat it. So, according to some, that if you know for sure that it's Maaser Rishon, if, let's say, you're growing produce in your backyard, mm-hmm. and you know for sure that it's Tevel, it has never been tithed, so you give, according to many, then you're supposed to give the Maaser Rishon to a Levi. Chaznish apparently hold that even in that case, you don't have to give the Maaser Rishon to a Levi, because we're still not sure that he's really a Levi. But if the produce is doubtfully tithed, so for example, you're not sure whether you had whether the tithes are separated properly, and you're doing it anyway because there's a suffix, and you need to make sure that it's taken care of. So then you certainly don't have to give it to a Levi, because tell the Levi, well, even if you are a Levi, so come prove to me that this has not been tithed already, and then you can take your Maaser Rishon. But again, there's certainly, either way, the only sin that you'll be committing is not giving it to a Levi, but you're not eating non-kosher produce. You're not eating something that's usher for you to eat, per se. You might be stealing from the Levi, but it's not treif. As opposed to the Truma, which is you're not allowed to eat at all. Ve'al zeh ha-seder, anu chayovim shenafresh minatua chalokim eila. So this is the order that we're supposed to separate the tithes. Uva'al anu ha-maniyah b'zeh shlonakdim mizeh ma'asheroi la'acher. No la'acher ma'asheroi la'haktim. So this mitzvah tells us that we're not supposed to change the order, that we're not supposed to do something early that Torah prescribes to be done afterwards, and not to do something late, what the Torah prescribes to be done early. But there's a way to do it. Shenemar, Meleascha v'dimacha lo sacher, your fullness and your holy produce you shall not make late. So it's the I looked in the JPS translation, by the way. It said meaning of Hebrew uncertain. So apparently these words are not exactly sure what they're referring to. I didn't have a BDB. I went to look at how they attached it.
Okay. Among the produce obligations that you set aside, from your grain or your fluid, do not postpone that which ought to have precedence.
Uh-huh. Okay. So... Okay, but it's referring... it's referring to the proper laws regarding the produce in any case.
Now, the word dema, dalet mem ayin, in rabbinic Hebrew certainly means truma. You have a stew, for example, that was mostly chulin, regular produce, and a little bit of truma got mixed in, then that's called miduma in rabbinic Hebrew. So certainly that word does have a history of referring to truma. So again, what it means is that you should not make late something that is supposed to become first in the laws governing your produce. Okay. Mishorshia mitzvah. The reasoning for the mitzvah ki behea sosa dvarim al sidran lo yavo behem ha'irbu vehatos. When you do something in the correct order, you're not going to make a mistake and forget to separate one of the tithes. Uchsheinam nasim kein ye hatos nimtza behen tamid. If you keep switching up the order, then you're going to get confused. You're going to make a mistake. The proper separation of tithes is a major tenet of the religion, which is very interesting. You wouldn't necessarily assume that. When it talks about the actual mitzvahs that you have to take out whatever tithe, the specific tithes, then the Sefer Chinuch is going to explain why it's so important in the grand scheme of the religion, why you take out the tithes. So God wanted us to make especially sure never ever to go in the incorrect order so that we should never make a mistake regarding their quantities. It's funny though because it's interesting because you're allowed to, just like you're allowed to be mater neder, so if you separate truma and meiser and you realize you made a mistake and you needed to undo it for some reason, you can go in front of a bezdin and you could be shoal al hamaisris. You could ask for a hatora on your separation of trumas and maisris, so you could undo it. So what? You could be released from your vow, like, so you undoes your separation, you can go ahead and do it again. So it's interesting. Mishomenu tov mizah min hamekubalim nekabel. Sefer Chinuch says, anybody has a better reason for me why this mitzvah should exist, so please let me know.
Okay, then the art scroll is they think that he acknowledges there's a need for Kabbalistic insight into the essence of the mitzvah.
I don't think that's what it means.
Okay.
And of course you have, in Israel nowadays, you have it separated multiple times. Because first the Rabbanut goes to separate the tithes from all the produce when they're first shipped from the farms. And then when the stores that are under the hashgacha of the badats buy fruits and vegetables from the large wholesalers, of course they don't trust the rabbanut, so they separate all the tithes again. And then you have some very extremely religious consumers who buy from the badats produce stores, and they don't trust the badats, they separate it properly, so they separate all the tithes themselves again at home. The Briskerov was very into that. Because there was an institution in the times of the Mishnah called accepting upon oneself to be Ne'eman al Hamaisris. That in order, they created an institution called Demai, which meant that even if somebody who, let's say a regular Jew, told you that this was, the tithes were properly separated, you were not allowed to believe him unless he had a special certification, so to speak, that he was responsible in the realm of separating tithes. And so only people who went up publicly and they accepted, I will always separate my own tithes and I will only eat by people who are also certified, they would join the club of people who you were allowed to rely on for separating trumas and maisers, otherwise you had to separate it yourself. So there are basically two approaches to how this works nowadays. The Chazon Ish, who generally takes a more approach to halacha that's more like, okay, what did Chazal have in mind? How would this halacha work nowadays? He generally says, okay, so we don't have this institution anymore, so you're allowed to eat by people who you know are responsible for taking out the Truma Sumaisris. And if somebody's not responsible, then you're not allowed.
You're not allowed to eat by them.
Unless you separate your own tithes. And the Briskerov felt, Briskerov had a much more literalistic approach to halacha. The Briskerov felt that what Chazal meant is that they instituted a rabbinic halacha that anyone who did not have this official certification was not believed regarding Trumas Umaisris.
Mm-hmm.
So he says nowadays that we don't have the official certification, mm-hmm. that it went out of, it's not in use anymore,
mm-hmm.
then you're not allowed to trust anyone. You're not allowed to eat by anyone else's house without separating your own Trumas Umaisris.
So wait, somebody serves a salad and you sort of...
You have to take from each little...
But you can't do that on Shabbos.
There are ways out of it on Shabbos. There are ways out to do it on Shabbos. But, but the other approach taken by Rabbi Avadi Yosef and other more liberal poskim than either of the two I just mentioned, and certainly as a general minhag, that since basically all the fruit and vegetables that is sold have people responsible, the hashgachos, the mashkichim, are responsible for taking out the Trumas Umaisris on an industrial level, so that alleviates any concern. So any produce that anybody is going to buy is going to already have a hashgacha on it. And that's, even within mainstream halacha, isn't pretty much not in accordance with either the views of the Chazon Ish and the Briskerov, that hold that either you're not allowed to trust anyone or you're only allowed to trust people who you know separate it themselves. And so the Rav Yoshev held this way. This is the normative approach, is that if you know that you're allowed to rely on a hashgacha, because the hashgacha, there is precedent for the idea that if you have people who are specifically responsible for taking out Trumas Umaisris, then this whole institution of Demai doesn't really come into play. So if you have you buy under a reliable hashgacha, then you don't have to, strictly speaking, you do not have to separate your own Trumas Umaisris. If you know the person that you're eating by buys from a store with a reputable hashgacha, then you don't have to separate your own Trumas Umaisris. However, he says that there is a chumrah. Rav Yoshev himself said it makes sense as a chumrah to separate your own tithes, because there are lots of chashoshes, and a lot of times on an industrial level, people don't take as great care as they do in a private home. So he says it makes sense as a chumrah to separate your own tithes anyway.
What about
baltashkes? Baltashkes, strictly speaking, doesn't apply for in mitzvah purposes. That if you're doing something for a mitzvah. Not necessarily recommended if you're really not on that level. If you're not machmir on anything else, and then all of this thing you decide you want to be machmir on to separate all your own tithes, then maybe that doesn't make too much sense. But midinei hamitzvah, dalachos ar mash amru zichronim livracha. Shim avar vehikdim binyan zeh mash einu roi lahakdim mash asah. So if you did it, that you did the improper order when you're separating the tithes, then it works. B'diavad. Velo nechayvenu lachzor l'arif hakol v'yafrishim pam shni. You don't have to mix everything back together and do a she'ela, or if not do a she'ela, whatever, maybe it's nachal, because the Torah prescribed a different order, and to separate again, but rather your first hafrasha was correct. Well, I mean, not correct, but it worked. V'chema shedarshu maseches truma, uva mechilta meleyascha elu habikurim hanitalin min hamalai. So we have a drasha in Maseches Truma and in the Mechilta and the Medrash that when it says Melei Oschav, that you shouldn't make it late, that's also talking about the Bikurim, which are taken out of the full produce, that they're the first fruits that are separated and taken to Yerushalayim are the first thing that's taken out of the field. Kolomar, Kodem Shenital Min HaDovar Klum. So before this is taken, anything else is taken out, so you have to take out the Bikurim. Zeloshon Melei. Kolomar shehu kedavar shalom legamrei. That's something that's completely whole. V'dimacha zo truma lo ta'acher shelo taktim truma lebikurim. You shouldn't take out truma before the bikurim. V'yaser protev maseches truma. Again, all the details can be found in maseches truma, which is not in the Talmud Bavli, but rather it's in the Mishnah and in the Talmud Yerushalmi. V'noheges bizchar munikevos beretz Yisrael. Applies to men and women. Bizman Shisrael Sham, in the times when Jews are there, when you're chayiv in Trumas Umaisris Midaraisa. Kedasa Rambam Zichron al Bracha, Shekasov, Shemitzos, Trumas Umaisris Minatora, Eina Ela Bizman Sheretz Yisrael B'Yeshuva. The Rambam writes that Trumas Umaisris on a Daraisa level are only when most of the people of Israel are on their land. If you do the wrong one first, Dino Kaover al mitzvahs melech, you just violated the commandment of God, and that's, you know, shame on you. Aval ein loket alav, you don't receive the penalty of lashes, shekach desbar sham betruma, she'ein bezeh halav malkos, or tmura. Different gear sauce. So that this doesn't have malkos because it's ein v'maisa. It's actually machlokas amaroim and maseches tmura, whether you receive malkos on this or not. But the conclusion as presented here is that one does not receive the penalty of malkos for violating this. Moving right along, mitzvah ayin gimel, 73rd mitzvah, shelo lechol treifa, not to eat a treif animal. So shelo lechol treifa, not to eat a treif animal, and this doesn't mean the colloquial uses of treif as anything that's not kosher, it means an animal that has certain defects. Shelo lechol min ha-treifa, sheneemar uvasor basadet treifa lo sochelu, you should not eat meat that's torn in the field, and mashmos ha-nigla b'kosuv zeh. The simple, plain understanding with this pasuk, hula hazireinu al behema she'tarfa ze'evo, turafa ze'evo ariba sadeh, that's talking about an animal that was struck by a wolf or a lion in the field. V'she'tarfa binyan she'netuya lamus b'tarfahu, that it smote it to such an extent that it's now on its way to the grave because of this event. Devat ha'ein v'macha she'im Noga berosh ozno shetalash mitzamra shetikare treifa bechach. So obviously, it's not called a treifa, even if a wolf swiped at it and it nicked its ear or it pulled out some hair. So that's insufficient for it to be considered a treifa, a torn animal. Elavada yamashmos anachon. The correct meaning is a kabbala mesayaz bechachu, and the received tradition of explanation supports this. It's going to die soon, directly due to this event. The received tradition of the sages is this, that this is 1 year. That the maximum amount that a treifa animal that has been smitten in such a manner, is 1 year.
Nobody worries about whether, in fact, the animal's going to survive for a year.
Right. The Sefer Chen is going to talk about that later, that we assume that we just follow the treifos that are enumerated by the sages, and we cannot conduct our own experimentation nowadays of whether this animal could actually live for a year or not. Otherwise, you make yourself nuts. You have to we just follow the accepted received list. V'od yesh lahavin L'chol neven ki lo takbet haTorah kishehigi ala tarfu zeh al yedei zevu ariyo dov. So it doesn't matter whether this type of wound, yes. So any type of, this wound was due to a wolf or a lion or a bear, it doesn't matter if it's a due type of animal. Ela sheteotesor kol behem amuka maka hamavi oso de mavis al kopanim. It's any type of wound that's in the genre of what could be caused by an animal. Again, the sages enumerated the types of wounds that will cause the animal to die. Uchmo shebaba mishnah zehaklal kol shein kamo achaya treifa. The mishnah adds at the end of its discussion of the treifas that the general rule is that if something cannot live, if it has a similar wound, then it's considered a treifa. V'zesh amar kosu besada lav dafka. Also, the fact that it says basar basada treifa, that the meat is in the field. And it's also lav dafka. Why? Because Ela Shaderech HaKosuv L'daber Ba'olam Behove talks about what the general circumstances are. Uvesados Derech Behemos Lidrov. That is the normal circumstances, that it's out in the field that the animal could suffer a wound. V'cheinu B'mechilta Diber HaKosuv Behove. That's also what it says in the main halachic medrash on Sefer Shmos, that the Torah is talking in general terms. From this word of basada in the field, we learn out many other types of things. That the Torah can be explained in many different ways for using the same one word. The words of the Torah will dress in silk and different fine fabrics. And inside will be gold. There will be different ways of interpreting the same phrase in the Torah. That in the first glance, this pasuk is talking about something only that has suffered a physical defect. And also, that flesh that's separated from a live animal is in part of the prohibition of a trefa. That the internal explanation, which is not evident from a basic reading of the pasuk, shemlamin al kol basar sheyatza chutz mimichitzoso sheoser venase ketrefa. The any meat that left the place where it has to be, the normal place where the meat is to be found, becomes like a trefa, and you're not allowed to eat it. What does that mean? The place for the kodshi kodshim, the highest level of holy sacrifices, must be in the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash, and that's the place. And if that meat leaves the courtyard, then you're no longer allowed to eat it. The kohanim or whoever would have been entitled to eat this meat is no longer allowed to do it because it left the proper place. Ubasar kodshim kalim shiyatza chutz lachoma, and the kodshim kalim, which have to be eaten on Har HaBayis, if they left the city of Yerushalayim, if they left the walls of Yerushalayim, it's also not allowed to be eaten subsequently. Once it goes out, that's it. Ubasar pesach shiyatza chutz lachabura, and we know that the pesach has to be eaten with the group of people that originally intended to eat this sacrifice together. If it leaves the chabura, that's also asar, as we discussed, by the way, you know, several months ago. If an animal stuck it part of it out of the womb, then that part is not if let's say you shech the mother now, so this part of the fetus is not edible. It does not come under the shechita of the mother because it left its place. So it sticks out one hoof, then you shech the mother. And this fetus, then you find this fetus inside. So you're not allowed, you have to cut off that one part of the animal because that part is yatzachutz
mechitzoso. All of these being out of place, these actually are, as it were, toldos of this.
Yes, mitzvah. Absolutely.
I got thrown off by all the silks and pearls and all that business. I wasn't sure whether he was talking metaphorically here.
Okay. No, it's really. No, because you shechted the mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the baby.
The fetus, technically speaking, is mutter because of the shechita of the mother. Umashmauso shel mikra yavo kein kil amar vasar basadet treifahu. That it's as if the pasuk says meat that's in the field is considered to be a treifa rather than meat in the field that was torn. Kil amar basar sheyatza chutz mechitzoso. Let's say the meat went into the field, which is a place it's not supposed to be. Shezeu loshon sadesh ein lo mechitzes. It has no. A field has no walls, so it's outside the proper place. Treifahu. Okay, that's a drasha, whatever. Michol Eilish is a charnus yatzu chutz lemichitzatzon v'dinan k'treifa. All these tight examples of things that went outside the proper place and their halacha is equivalent to that of a treifa. Umishachol ben kazayis loketz, an absolute din d'oraisa, that if you eat a kazayis of meat that went out of the proper place, then you receive the penalty of lashes as if you ate mamish a treifa. And then we'll continue with treifa. Next time we can talk about glatt kosher and not glatt kosher and all these gishmaka things. Mm-hmm.